This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
The UN says a recent Iran-Saudi Arabia deal on the resumption of diplomatic ties can prepare the ground for peace in war-torn Yemen. The Syrian president says Damascus welcomes any Russian proposal to boost its troop deployment to Syria. And scuffles break out as protests against the Israeli regime's judicial overhaul bill near the 11th week. Welcome to our studios in the capital, Tehran. This is News. Thanks for joining us. The UN Special Envoy for Yemen says a recent Iran-Saudi Arabia deal on the resumption of diplomatic ties can prepare the ground for peace in war-torn Yemen.
Intense diplomatic efforts are ongoing at different levels to bring the conflict in Yemen to an end. We are currently witnessing renewed regional diplomatic momentum, as well as a step change in the scope and depth of the discussions. Allow me to also take this opportunity to welcome the recent agreement between Saudi Arabia and Iran to resume diplomatic ties, which was facilitated by the People's Republic of China. This dialogue and good neighborly relations are important for the region and for Yemen.
Grunberg was referring to the China-brokered rapprochement between Tehran and Riyadh. He also told the Security Council that Yemen's warring parties need to seize the opportunity to take decisive steps towards peace. Yemen and Saudi Arabia are currently in negotiations aimed at extending UN-backed troops that expired in October of last year. Riyadh, along with some regional allies and backed by the U.S., launched a war in Yemen back in 2015 to reinstate a friendly regime there. Years of aerial strikes and shelling, as well as blockade by the Saudi-led coalition, have devastated the impoverished Arab country, leaving tens of thousands of civilians dead in Yemen. The Secretary of Iran's Supreme National Security Council says the Islamic Republic is seeking to boost regional cooperation in line with the government's good neighbor policy. Ali Shamkhani said all regional countries should realize the fact that lasting security and stability can be achieved only through their collective efforts. If that happens, he added, they can hope to see new developments unfolding in bilateral and multilateral relations in the region. Shamkhani made the comments before departing for the United Arab Emirates on a day-long official visit. Iran's security chief is accompanied by an entourage of high-ranking officials. He said that Tehran and Abu Dhabi have much in common on economic, political, and security fronts and need to hold regular consultations to strengthen those bonds. Iran, China, and Russia have started a joint military drill in the northern part of the Sea of Oman. The drill, dubbed Security Bond 2023, is aimed at safeguarding security and peace in waters of the region. Our correspondent Mehdi Abbasian has more.
Chinese and Russian vessels have entered Iran's territorial waters to hold a joint maritime exercise in the Sea of Oman. Delegates from Pakistan and Kazakhstan navies will also be there as observers. China has dispatched a guided missile destroyer to the area, while Russia has sent a naval group that consists of a frigate and a medium sea tanker. At the first stage of the drill, the naval officers of the three countries reviewed episodes of the trilateral exercise on maps, received instructions, and held tactical briefings. Later, the naval commanders of the three countries held a joint presser. The Iranian Navy's deputy commander said the main aim of the joint exercise is to help safeguard security in the northern part of the Indian Ocean.
The northern part of the Indian Ocean is one of the most important maritime routes for international trade and transfer of energy. Therefore, providing security in combating piracy and terrorism requires cooperation among regional countries and allies with common interests in this region.
Meanwhile, Chinese and Russian Navy commanders said the joint exercise further demonstrates the preparedness of the participating countries to maintain security, and it will also deepen their practical cooperation. In an exclusive interview, Rear Admiral Tajetini told Press TV that the trilateral drill helps protect peace and stability in the region.
The trilateral exercise of Iran, China, and Russia has a four-year-long history, and our goals are clear. Our motto is together to provide peace and security. Therefore, we are only pursuing the interests of the Islamic Republic of Iran as well as collective interests of countries in the north of the Indian Ocean. We are cooperating with China and Russia in order to defend our interests and counter maritime piracy and terrorism.
This joint exercise is the third of its kind, following similar drills involving the Iranian, Chinese, and Russian navies in 2019 and 2022.
The main stage of the Security Bond 2023 exercises will be held in the coming days and will involve forces from the Marine and Airborne units of Iran's Navy and the IRGC, as well as Russian and Chinese flotillas. Matia Bosian from the location of the drill.
The spokesman for the drills, Rear Admiral Mustafa Tajedini, says the main mock operation involves freeing ships captured by pirates.
We went through the first day of the drill successfully, and tomorrow we're going to have the operational phase of the drills, and we're going to have naval units from the Army, IRGC, and also the navies of the Russian Federation and China, and that's going to be the executive phase of the drills. And we are going to have naval exercises by operation rooms and with different naval formations. We're going to have contacts amongst the operation rooms, and we are going to target the surface targets, and we're going to also have nighttime exercises, and on the next day we are going to have the main operation, which is actually freeing the ships and vessels that have been captured by pirates, and we are going to have our special operation forces, and later we are going to have the parade, and we are going to have the analysis of the operations as the conclusion of the drills.
Israeli protesters have blocked the main highway in Tel Aviv during a demonstration against the regime's judicial overhaul bill. Police moved to disperse the demonstrators, triggering sporadic scuffles. Similar protests were held in other cities. In the port of Haifa, some protesters attempted to block docking lanes. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has rejected a compromise plan supported by President Isaac Herzog. The president has expressed great concern about the future of the regime. Herzog says Israel is in a, quote, deep crisis. The drive by Netanyahu's far-right cabinet to go ahead with the reforms has sparked 10 consecutive weeks of protest. Hundreds of thousands of protesters have taken part in the demonstration so far. Israeli forces have shot dead three more Palestinians during an attack in the occupied West Bank city of Jenin. The Palestinian Health Ministry says five people were also wounded. Earlier today, Israeli forces similarly injured several Palestinians in the city of Nablus. The regime troops stormed the area to cover a number of Israeli settlers who were on their way to break into the archaeological site of Joseph's tomb. Israel has been conducting violent assaults on an almost daily basis since the formation of the regime's new far-right cabinet under Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Since the beginning of the year, nearly 90 Palestinians have been killed in the West Bank, either by the regime's troops or by settlers. Our correspondent Ramallah, Mona Kandil, gave us an update on the latest Israeli incursion into the occupied West Bank city of Nablus.
Israeli forces continue to raid Palestinian areas on a daily basis, claiming that they want to arrest Palestinians wanted for security reasons or Palestinians known to be fighters or taking part in any anti-Israel operations or activities. But what happened last night, Israeli forces raided Nablus area in order to protect the raid of a number of Israeli settlers who wanted to raid the Qabr Yusuf, Joseph's camp in Nablus. As usual, clashes took place because Palestinians there tried to push out the settlers out of the site. Clashes erupted between Israeli forces and Palestinians there. At least five were shot by rubber-coated bullets, in addition to dozens, almost over 50 Palestinians have suffered suffocation due to inhaling tear gas. We have to say that elsewhere across the occupied West Bank, a number of Palestinians had been arrested during military raids, according to a statement by the Palestinian Prisoners Society. Palestinians had been urging the international community and the European Union to force the Israeli military, the Israeli regime, to stop its illegal daily raids under the unjustified excuse forcing Palestinians to quit resistance. At the end of the day, Palestinians say they have the right to continue to be adherent to their choice of resistance, to fight the Israeli soldiers, to protect themselves, their families, and their lands.
The Syrian president has hailed Russia for backing his country's sovereignty and territorial integrity. Bashar al-Assad also welcomed any Russian proposal to set up new military base in Syria. Assad, who is on a trip to Moscow, said Russia's support for Syria remains strong despite its special military operation in Ukraine. He noted that the Russian military presence in Syria should not be temporary or merely related to fighting terrorism. Assad also thanked his Russian counterpart for sending aid and rescue teams to help Syrians after a devastating earthquake hit northern and the western parts of the country. On Wednesday, Vladimir Putin hosted Assad for talks that largely focused on rebuilding Syria, mending its ties with Turkey.
Russian President Vladimir Putin held talks with Syrian President Bashar al-Assad in the Kremlin. The head of states of the two countries are in constant contact as relations between Moscow and Damascus are developing in various areas.
Thanks to our joint efforts and the decisive contribution of the Russian armed forces, significant results have been achieved in Syria in the fight against international terrorism. This makes it possible to stabilize the socio-economic and domestic political situation. Unfortunately, the Syrian people faced another very serious problem, a catastrophe, an earthquake. This, of course, exacerbates the situation. As real friends, we are trying to support you. As you know, our units under the Ministry of Emergency Situations also worked here, and representatives of the armed forces stationed in Syria are also contributing to the fight against the consequences of the earthquake.
Meanwhile, Assad expressed support for Russia's special operation in Ukraine and thanked Moscow for its help following the earthquake.
This is my first visit since the beginning of this special operation in Ukraine, and I would like to repeat we fully support your fight against neo-Nazis and old Nazis. I'm talking about the old Nazis because the West has always received them on the ground and now continues to help them. We support this special operation not because our countries are friends. Our position proceeds from the fact that the world really needs a stabilization now, otherwise it will come to collapse.
This visit has several important components. Syria survived a devastating earthquake with many victims. Syria needs economic help and assistance. Syria has problems with energy prices, which have risen. As an important ally of Russia, it will receive this assistance. The second component is no less important. A meeting of representatives of Iran, Turkey, and Russia at the level of deputy ministers of foreign affairs is to be held in Moscow, where a potential unfreezing of relations between Damascus and Ankara will be discussed. The very fact of such negotiations in Moscow already speaks of a positive trend.
The situation in Syria and bilateral military cooperation were discussed by the defense ministers of the two countries. Sergei Shoigu, in a conversation with his counterpart Ali Mahmoud Abbas, expressed condolences to the Syrian people in connection with the February earthquake and stressed the importance of close contacts, which are aimed at maintaining stability in the Arab country in the field of defense and the fight against terrorism.
The visit by the Syrian president is indicative of strengthening ties between the two countries. The Syrian-Turkish dossier is another important outcome of this visit. The near future will show whether this will lead to the restoration of ties between Syria and Turkey. Marina Kartunova, Moscow.
U.S. and South Korean troops have staged joint war games, including air combat operations, amid rising tensions on the Korean Peninsula. The drills are part of the ongoing 11-day military exercises dubbed Freedom Shield 23. This comes as North Korea has launched another long-range ballistic missile. The South Korean military says the projectile was fired from the Sunan area in Pyongyang. Japan also confirmed that the missile was an ICBM, saying that it fell outside of the country's exclusive economic zone. The missile launch was the third by the North this week amid large-scale joint military drills by the U.S. and South Korea. The allies claim that such maneuvers are essential for regional and global stability. However, North Korea considers them as a hostile act and a rehearsal for the invasion of its territory. Asian stocks have plunged as the liquidity crisis of a Switzerland-based global investment and financial firm has invoked fears among investors and creditors. Japan's benchmark Nikkei dropped 1.3%, while Asia-Pacific shares outside of Japan fell nearly 1%. Sentiment was fragile and a nervous air hung over the market after Credit Suisse's stock plunged as much as 30% overnight, causing the Swiss franc to suffer its biggest drop in 7 years. Credit Suisse has, however, announced that it would borrow over $50 billion from the Swiss central bank to reinforce itself. The move follows a decision by the firm's main stakeholders not to inject money to the grid. Global stock markets are in turmoil since last week, following the collapse of the U.S.-based Silicon Valley Bank. Police have clashed with protesters in Greece amid a massive strike by workers again last month's train disaster, which killed 57 people. Protesters took to the streets of Athens, Thessaloniki, and Petras. The crowd marched on the parliament building, blaming Prime Minister Mitsotakis for the train tragedy. The government is under fire for the mismanagement of the railway network. The country's transport minister has resigned in the wake of the deadly incident. And Prime Minister Mitsotakis has already apologized to the victims' families, promising a thorough investigation. The French Senate has approved President Emmanuel Macron's controversial pension reforms bill, following months of protests and debate.
The vote is closed. Results of the vote: 345 voters, 307 votes cast, 193 for, 114 against. The Senate has adopted the bill.
The green light to the bill was given with the support of the Conservative Republican Party. Now, the only step left for the text to be adopted is the vote of the lower house of parliament in the National Assembly. The margin there is believed to be far thinner for Macron. Opinion polls show that a vast majority of people oppose the changes, as do trade unions. Since the introduction of the unpopular bill several months ago, France has been mired in protests and strikes. The government seeks to raise the retirement age from 62 to 64, arguing that it is the only way to prevent the collapse of the current system. And that is it for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/parstodayen. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/parstodayenglish.
in the limelight.
Human rights group Al-Mizan has found that the Zionist regime's drones or unmanned aerial vehicles have killed at least 2,146 Palestinians and damaged 3,332 homes from 2000 to 2022. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. The Electronic Intifada wrote in this regard, Atallah al-Attar, 35, gets anxious in the evenings. He lives on his family's farm in the town of Beit Lahia in northern Gaza Strip, close to the boundary with the occupied Palestinian territories. Evenings are when the Zionist regime's drones most often fly overhead. On this particular January afternoon, he softly explained why he has an acute fear of drones. He said, "The incident is very painful. In May 2019, he was working as a security guard at a wedding venue in Beit Lahia. He was taking a break with a friend, Khaled Abu Ghaliq, 24, when they saw and heard the Zionist regime drones flying overhead, which was not unusual. Al-Attar thought the drones were just surveilling the area, but then the men felt the explosion. Al-Attar said, the explosion made a huge sound, and the shrapnel from the missile flew at us. Shrapnel hit Al-Attar in the eye and the legs. The pain was excruciating, but he mostly recalls his friends' cries for help. One moment, Al-Attar remembers, Abu Aliq was eating a meal and drinking coffee in nearby shipping container. The next, debris and shrapnel had hit Abu Ghaliq in the head. And by the time an ambulance arrived, he was unconscious. It was while Al-Attar was receiving treatment for his wounds at the hospital that he learned of Abu Ghaliq's death. A subsequent Human Rights Watch report stated that the Zionist regime drone had bombed a metal shipping container outside a businessman's villa and found that none of the individuals killed or injured by the Zionist strike had any ties to armed Palestinian groups. Doctors amputated Al-Attar's foot, and he now walks with crutches. He has four children, but he is currently unable to work, neither as a security guard nor on his family's farm, harvesting strawberries and grain. He said, Israeli regime drones are not only for reconnaissance and killing. They also sabotage water farms by spraying pesticides. I have seen this before, and the drones give me constant anxiety. They killed my friend, and they almost killed me. The Zionist regime began using drones in the extrajudicial killings of Palestinians in 2004, according to Al-Mizan, and nearly a decade later, they have grown to be the most lethal weapons, particularly in assassinations and attacks on crowds. Drones have much longer flying times, states Human Rights Watch, and some are able to operate continuously for more than 24 hours. Military researcher Yusuf al-Sharghawi, a retired Palestinian Authority major general, said that the Zionist regime's most used drones in Gaza are the quadcopter and the Hermes 450, the latter of which conducts nighttime surveillance with its infrared sensors and can carry missiles. He said drones take videos, track and assassinate. They also direct bomber aircrafts. Israel is looking to develop these drones to have the most powerful drones in the West Asia region. But in Gaza, they are the most lethal weapons and violate international humanitarian law. Palestinian factions have downed drones in Gaza most recently on January 27th, and with Hamas saying that important sensitive information was obtained. The Israeli regime's war on Gaza during the summer of 2014 brutally demonstrated the destructive reach of drones. While Defense for Children International Palestine found evidence suggesting that Israeli regime forces directly targeted children that summer, with drones killing at least 164 children, other attacks carried out by the Zionist regime throughout Gaza targeted many more civilians. Anwar al-Zanin, 43, an employee of the Palestinian Center for Human Rights, had reported that an Israeli regime strike had damaged a water line near his home in northern Gaza Strip town of Beit Hanun, and the municipality sent workers to repair it. Sofyan Abu Harbit, 49, and Majdi Shabat, 50, were repairing the water line when an Israeli regime drone dropped yet another missile nearby. All three men were injured by the strike and taken to the hospital. Abu Harbid's leg was fractured, and Shabbat sustained injuries to his back, arms, and hands. Azanin was more seriously wounded and died later. Now, Abu Harbid refuses to work while Israeli regime drones are in the sky, as the attack produced a lasting psychological trauma. "The event is still terrifying me," he said, adding, "At first, the presence of drones just meant it was monitoring our movements, but now the army intends to hurt and kill us from all directions, sea, land, and air. The Israeli army can kill us without justification." Hala Abu Hajar, 38, lives in the village of Johr, east of Gaza City. She is a widow and the mother of four children. "Drones are active in the area," she explains. Like Al-Attar, who was injured by the drone strike in Beit Lahia, Abu Hajar also notes that the drones come out most often in the evenings. They are so high-pitched and loud and deafening vibration that it feels like they are another occupant in her home. During the 2014 war, she was walking with her children when she saw an Israeli regime drone drop missiles on a car and a motorcycle. She's now more afraid of drones than warplanes, she said. "Sometimes when my children are playing near the house and they hear the sound of drones, they run back into the house. They are afraid the drones are going to bomb them." She believes their fear is justified, and she's also afraid. "Evenings at home should be peaceful," she said, "but the drones make this impossible. There is barely a moment when she's not thinking of the drones and what they are capable of. The attacks feel unpredictable, even though their buzzing sound is unmistakable," she said. "Whenever I hear the drones, I feel danger nearby. Tension, headaches, anxiety, and sometimes I can't sleep." According to Mehr News Agency, the Zionist regime withdrew its troops from Gaza in 2005. 2 years later, though, the regime imposed a crippling blockade on the Palestinian territory after the Islamic resistance movement Hamas rose to power there. Ever since, The regime of Tel Aviv has waged three wholesale wars on the territory. Observers say the combination of the siege and military assaults is meant to render what is already the world's largest open-air prison even more uninhabitable. Over the past months, the fabricated regime of Israel has also ramped up attacks on Palestinian towns and cities throughout the occupied territories. As a result of these attacks, dozens of Palestinians have lost their lives and many others have been arrested. More than 170 Palestinians, including at least 30 children, were killed across the West Bank and East Al-Quds last year. In January 2023 alone, well over 30 Palestinians, including 5 children, have been killed. The United Nations marked 2022 as the deadliest year for Palestinians in the West Bank in 16 years.
Hidden Files.
But Cece never saw her husband's face again because her plane crashed that morning at 10:03. What took place on 9/11 was the deadliest attack on U.S. soil ever, which took the lives of almost 3,000 people. People whom some of their heartbreaking stories have been told and retold over and over again by mainstream media. But the greatest toll this incident took was neither on September the 11th nor in America. And that's where millions more heartbreaking stories are waiting to be heard. Hello and welcome to Hidden Files. I'm Marzieh Hashemi, and today I'm here to share with you stories of the fall of people who had nothing to do with the 9/11 attacks. People who fell victim to the campaign that started following September 11th. A campaign named the War on Terror. Following the September 11th attacks, U.S. President George W. Bush declared a global military war on terror campaign. He called on world leaders to join the U.S. in this fight and said, every nation in every region now has a decision to make. Either you are with us or with the terrorists. Bush then stated how this war on terror was to unfold. Our war on terror begins with Al-Qaeda, but it does not end there. It will not end until every terrorist group of global reach has been found, stopped, and defeated. Well, let's look at how a lot of these events unfolded. October the 7th, 2001, airstrikes were launched in Afghanistan by the U.S. and the U.K., followed by a ground offensive. Now, more than 240,000 Afghans were killed as a direct result. And then if we go forward to March the 19th, 2003, U.S. and coalition forces invaded Iraq, claiming that the country had weapons of mass destruction. More than 300,000 Iraqis were killed as a direct result. Today, the War on Terror campaign continues to be used as an excuse for bombing people from Afghanistan to Yemen. According to the Cost of War Project, by 2021, over 900,000 people had been killed in the war on terror, and over 80 countries are currently being targeted by the war on terror today. But was this War on Terror campaign a sudden decision in the aftermath of 9/11? Or were the attacks used as an excuse to justify a full-fledged pre-planned war? Well, our first guest, Scott Ritter, who is a whistleblower and former intelligence officer, is here with us to discuss more.
Scott Ritter, United States Marine Corps intelligence officer, who was a chief weapons inspector with the UN in Iraq from 1991 to 1998. Mr. Ritter quit the inspections team in 1998. He became a whistleblower and a critic of the Bush administration's claims that Iraq had weapons of mass destruction.
Thanks so much for being with us, Scott, here on Hidden Files. I mean, can you explain your perspective exactly what the concept of war on terror means?
We were attacked on 9/11. Now, we can have a discussion about whether or not this was blowback from, decades of American malpractice and malfeasance in the Middle East. That's a fair point. But we did not invite this attack. We did not want this attack. We did not will this attack. We were attacked. And, you know, the world saw that and recognized that. That's why the world rallied behind the United States in the aftermath of 9/11, saying this was unwarranted. This was unjust. This was horrible. And we will support the United States. But they weren't willing to support the United States in carrying out a counteroffensive that went beyond simply punishing those who perpetrated the attack. And that's what the war on terror became. It wasn't about punishing Al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden. It was about American asserting dominance on an entire region, and indeed, by doing so, on the entire world. And that's what the war on terror was. It wasn't a war on terror. It was basically a war of regional and global domination by the United States using a horrible act of terrorism as justification.
Well, do you feel that there was a plan to attack Iraq even prior to the September 11th attacks?
I think the Department of Defense had been heavily engaged with Iraq over the decade of the 90s, and that there were military contingencies in place that could have the United States defeating Iraq, occupying Iraq. These were plans. They weren't necessarily fully developed. The CIA would play a supporting role in that, but there is ample evidence that the United States had plans in the works for invading and occupying Iraq prior to 9/11.
Well, what are some of the lingering effects of the U.S. war on Iraq?
The war in Iraq has never ended. I mean, it continues to this day. The political instability that we see in Baghdad is a direct consequence of the decision by the United States to invade and occupy Iraq in 2003.
Well, do you think that the U.S. would have invaded Iraq even if the 9/11 attacks hadn't taken place, since Iraq really had nothing to do with those attacks anyway?
I think the events of 9/11 accelerated the inevitable military conflict between the United States and Iraq that had been brewing for over a decade since the end of Operation Desert Storm in 1991. The Clinton administration in 1998 had put in place a law that basically codified regime change as the official policy of the United States government. And the United States was moving toward a decisive confrontation with Iraq that would have occurred whether or not 9/11 took place. I think 9/11 accelerated this, but the American public was already pre-programmed to accept the notion that Saddam Hussein was an evil that needed to be confronted and destroyed. And they were unquestioning about the weapons of mass destruction narrative that was being put forward by the United States government well before 9/11.
Well, in your perspective, who benefited from the war?
I mean, the short-term benefit was getting rid of Saddam Hussein, who had proven to be a perpetual thorn in the side of multiple American presidential administrations. His continued survival was an embarrassment to the United States. But beyond that, the United States gained no benefit. This was a colossal failure. It was a failure from almost day one. We never won over the Iraqi people. We were always seen as an occupying force. And that notion of the American occupier flew in the face of what we were trying to promote, which is the role of the United States as a liberator, promulgating the model of American democracy as something that should be emulated regionally. Instead, we became the brutal occupier, and we turned the region and indeed much of the world against us. There's nothing positive that came out of America's precipitous invasion and occupation of Iraq.
Well, thank you so much for being with us right here on Hidden Files, Scott Ritter. Now, the war on terror was not limited to bombing locations claimed to be terrorist hotspots in different countries. It entailed control of countries and their resources. One example of such control was when Paul Bremer, an American diplomat, was deployed to Iraq, where he became the country's chief executive authority following the U.S.'s invasion. Now, he wanted to implement 100 different orders in Iraq through one of Bremer's orders. The Iraqi army was dismantled, also using Coalition Provisional Authority, CPA. Bremer changed the Iraqi constitution to benefit American authorities. For instance, CPA's draft included banning political parties opposed to the U.S.'s occupation from participating in elections. And so from the U.S. controlling any government that would come to be in Iraq to the country even losing autonomy over its seed bank for farming, every aspect of life in Iraq was affected. Neoliberalism was being infused throughout the country, and it wasn't the Iraqi people who were profiting. There was a major heist during the occupation on so many levels, from cultural artifacts being stolen to the national wealth of the country's oil being completely controlled by the U.S. to the billions of dollars that Western contractors won. Now, let's take a look at some of these contractors.
The number of contractors on the ground outnumbered U.S. troops most years of the U.S. occupation. American politicians were invested in the contractors. Many of them owned stocks in these contractors' companies. U.S. politicians had personal interests and stocks in these contractors. 51 congressmen and women, along with their spouses, own between $2.3 and $5.8 million worth of stocks in the top 30 defense contractor companies. The Big Five, Lockheed Martin, Boeing, General Dynamics, Raytheon and Northrop Grumman, and some others acquired the next tier of manufacturers such as Hughes Aircraft and McDonnell Douglas. In the year to June 2020, the Big Five accounted for nearly a third of the $480 billion obligated by the Pentagon to defense contractors. Meanwhile, the defense sector spent over $2.4 billion lobbying Congress since 2001. These defense contractors make direct campaign contributions to most congressional members. 1. Lockheed Martin. Total sales, $46.5 billion. Gross profit, $2.7 billion. 2. Boeing. Total sales, $68.7 billion. Gross profit, $4 billion. 3. BAE. Total sales, $30.7 billion. Gross profit, $2.3 billion. 4. General Dynamics. Total sales, $32.7 billion. Gross profit, $2.5 billion. 5. Northrop Grumman. Total sales, $26.4 billion. Gross profit, $2.1 billion.
I'd like to welcome my next guest to the program, Dr. Ranjit Brar.
Ranjit Brar. Dr. Brar is a political analyst, a journalist, and a public speaker. He has been actively involved in the British anti-war movement for 30 years. Brar regularly contributes to the workers' journals Proletarian and Laocoon. He is the author of Britain's Road to Socialism.
Thanks so much for joining me. Do you feel that there was a plan to attack Iraq prior to the September 11th attacks?
Well, I think the clearest indication that there was a pre-existing plan to attack Iraq prior to September 11th, 2001, was, of course, the fact that the original invasion of Iraq had taken place in 1990-1991 under George H. Bush. At that time, whilst Saddam Hussein was much weakened and Iraq was much weakened, and the oil for food program of quite draconian sanctions was installed upon Iraq. And famously, Madeleine Albright, of course, at that time said it was worth the pain inflicted on the Iraqi people, in particular the 500,000 children who died of malnutrition and related diseases due to those sanctions. Madeleine Albright quite clearly said, yes, it was worth it. So there was obviously a pre-existing plan to invade Iraq. In terms of the 2003 invasion, there had been a plan. General Wesley Clark gave an interview in which he quite clearly said, in around the 2001 attacks, when he was visiting Rumsfeld and Wolfowitz in the Pentagon, they'd clearly intimated him a plan not only to attack Iraq, but in fact a list of seven other countries in the immediate future.
Well, do you think the attacks were needed to use as justification for invading these countries?
In terms of whether 9/11, September 11, the attacks on the Twin Towers, Pentagon and White House, because let's not forget it was all three sites that were initially attacked, were a useful justification. They were certainly used as a useful justification. Were they necessary to justify those acts of aggression by the United States? Personally, whilst they were clearly, you know, they pitched their media to a level of hysteria and hyperbole not seen before or since, and pivoted towards the war on terror as justification for all of their aggressive operations abroad. In fact, that was nothing new in a sense, and really the Monroe Doctrine since 1847 had declared, you know, U.S. a right to dominate the Western Hemisphere, the Americas, as their own territorial sphere of interest, as their own colony, their de facto colony, their zone to exploit. You know, it was in the aftermath of the collapse of the Soviet Union, really, that the United States and Bush, after Reagan, had really said there would be a new world order. This was the era in which America would be a world policeman, in which they would really come to now dominate the globe. And that unipolar moment, as we can call it, is a historical moment, has been continuing to this day. So was September 11th used by the United States establishment? Absolutely. Did they need that to justify their aggressive and hostile actions? Well, if you look at the American history, there have been perhaps 4 or 5 years in the total history of America when they've not been at war with one or another country. It's a country founded on genocide, essentially, and an empire founded upon ongoing bloodshed. There's not really been a single day's peace since the Second World War. America has been continual at war with other nations around the globe. So my personal feeling is that while they used it to their own advantage, they spun the media into a state of frenzy, they would have done exactly the same had September the 11th not occurred.
Who benefited from the war on Iraq?
That's a very good question. So the precise figures of the profits made by the US state and in particular US companies, you know, are hard to calculate. They will certainly run into hundreds of billions and trillions of dollars, and that would be the direct looting of Iraq's oil, which was the fundamental reason for going in. Saddam Hussein, of course, was threatening to flout US diktat, no longer comply with producing the necessary quantities of oil at the necessary prices in the interests of the US, and rather was going to cooperate with OPEC. So they lost control of Saddam Hussein, and this very important Iraq has perhaps 10-15% of the world's proven oil reserves, as has other important countries, of course, including Iran and Kuwait, Saudi in the region. What were the other things they benefited from? So the war itself, the incredible military expenditure. US has a military budget of $850 billion per annum on military, more than enough to solve the vast majority of the world's problems in healthcare, in nutrition, and in housing. But of course, that money is not dedicated to solving those problems, but to reinforcing America's exploitation of the world and their exploitative position. But Lockheed Martin, Boeing, so many US defense contractors and companies made literally a killing, but absolute fortune in monetary terms from the war itself and from the sales of weapons to the American government, to the British government, to the coalition of the willing, so-called, and to other nations based on their testing of weapons on an army which, relatively speaking, you know, was absolutely unable to defend itself against this huge onslaught of the world's largest industrial powers under the NATO umbrella. In addition to that, of course, There were huge contracts for reconstruction and occupation of Iraq over an extended period of time. And given the size of the bases and contractors who still operate in Iraq, you can see that those profits and loot are ongoing. And of course, ultimately, all of the money to pay for all of those operations came, in addition to an extent from the American taxpayer, overwhelmingly from loot extracted from the Iraq. And that includes, incidentally, the confiscation of the gold bullion reserves of the central bank. So however you look at it, you know, this was an absolute, not even a neo-colonial, but a classical colonial operation of plunder, which meant that Iraq went from being one of the most prosperous countries on earth, more prosperous than most southern European nations, more prosperous than Spain, arguably more prosperous than Italy, certainly more prosperous than Greece, to being one of the poorest countries on earth, where chaos still rules. And this is precisely, of course, the intended desire, because while that chaos rules, while the Iraqi people can't demand the repatriation of their oil wealth, that looting continues.
Can you explain the concept of war on terror and how it served those who instigated this concept?
The concept of the war on terror was a very useful device to find a new enemy, to justify the reason for not only ongoing military expenditure, ongoing NATO alliance, but in fact its constant expansion. As we've seen, NATO has been expanding right up towards the borders of Russia and China. So global domination, in fact, was the name of the game. But that was portrayed, you know, as America was a victim, America was the great upholder of democracy, America would be the world's policeman. It was America's mission to go and impose, you know, democracy, the free market, and institutions of NATO, EU, and other military alliances, essentially that served their own military and economic machine. So this essentially was making the world safe for the penetration of American capital. But, you know, war after war after war was fought against people after people to stop them having independent governments that would put the interests of those nations first.
Well, thank you so much for being with us right here in Hidden Files. September 11th was indeed a tragic event, but thanks to mainstream media, what many don't realize is that the main victims of the 9/11 incident were not Americans. They were unarmed civilians. They were Iraqi families, unsuspecting of who may break into their homes. Other victims of 9/11 were women and children being terrorized in their homes, and many are still being born with signs of terror all over their bodies, with horrifying birth defects due to depleted uranium and other chemicals. Birth defects like they were killed, wounded, and uprooted, not in the thousands, but in the millions. And yet they were neither paid reparations, nor did they even receive an official apology. And more importantly, there has been no accountability for the crimes committed, as trillions of dollars have been spent to cause havoc and to line the pockets of those heavily invested in war and chaos. Well, Hidden Files will continue to bring your attention to what's going on with this war on terror that was declared 21 years ago and is still causing death and destruction around the globe. Now, that's it for me, Marzia Hashemi, and all the crew here on Hidden Files.
The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iran Sat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.